Brigadier Calvert, Real 9.
I was saying I'd found, when we boarded the river steamer, that I'd left a party behind, and so we had to circle around because we had to land with the boat pointing upstream and land again. Whilst we recovered the party, my batman, Private Williams, and I went on to the, climbed up the embankment. We saw about 30 or 40 Japanese all looking down onto the ground. I don't know what it was. They were all looking down on the ground. Perhaps it was a corpse or something. And we were about 20 yards away. And so we opened up with our Thompson submachine guns and used a complete 38 rounds each into this bunch. And I think we killed most of them. We then got down into the sticky mud of the embankment and got on board ship. And with the Royal Marine torpedo boat giving us covering fire against some, we steamed upstream. It was then either that day or the day after that I got this message asking me to go back to Maymu, because it was a very, very important message, you see, and to hand over to Colonel Musgrave, who'd meet me at a particular place. Well, I had been doing this deception. I realized I was a small force, and so we were, I wouldn't allow any of the troops to stay in one position for more than 4 hours. We were moving all the time. And I think this is one of the tactics of guerrillas. Musgrave, who had been brought up to a very much more solid type of tactics, he parked this force into a village, which I would always avoid, and he gave them positions at night and then went to sleep. The Japanese attacked and wiped out most of them, but about 12... one lot got away under Musgrave onto the boat. About 12 of the others were lined up, were captured, were stripped naked and lined up to be shot. To be bayoneted, because the Japanese were taught not to waste ammunition on killing prisoners and not to waste men guarding prisoners when they were in the front line, and so this was their only solution. Two men ran for it, Private Williams, who was a Welshman, and a Sergeant Major, whose name I forget. They managed to swim the Irrawaddy, which was about 1,000 yards wide at the time, and made their way up to Prome, where they, still naked, where they reported their operations. And I was very annoyed with Musgrave, but I suppose it wasn't his fault. It's very, very difficult to hand over, like handing over a poker cards in a poker game. It's very difficult to hand over a deception program to another officer. And that really is the end of that. Then the war came on up Burma, and I was had an interview with General Alexander and was told to form a battalion. Now, the only troops I had were my own staff, which were about 5 officers and 17 men. I had sent out all the administrative personnel, including a lot of Indians, to make on the trek to India. I recruited men from Maymew, and the only big sources of recruitment were what you do after an illness, you recuperate. It was the convalescent hospital, and the people under arrest in the glasshouse. And I got a lot of these convalescents, some of whom were very fine soldiers, and some and the NCOs, with some had a bullet still inside them. And we were told to protect the Gotek Viaduct Bridge. And then the others were from detention barracks. Some of these had been deserters, others had been committed some quite minor crimes of stealing and things like that. We were on the Gotek Viaduct, and there was a Gurkha. I think these were Burmese Gurkhas, company without any white officers, who were also protecting it. But the Gotek Viaduct, which was a fantastic bridge, about 1,000 feet above the water, it was built on a natural bridge, and it was the greatest drop of a bridge possibly in the world. And I longed to blow it up because it'd be a great thing to do from an engineer's point of view. The Gurkhas said that we couldn't lay our explosives, but we eventually agreed with them to lay the explosives. And then the Japanese pushed up through the Shan states with the Chinese retreating. And their one getaway to China was across the Gotek Viaduct. I kept asking Alexander's headquarters whether I could blow the thing up, and I kept getting the message to say no, and to leave it to the Chinese. It's under the Chinese sphere of influence. So I handed it over to the Chinese for them to blow up, and because we were ordered to retreat. And the next time I saw Alexander, he said, "Did you blow the bridge up?" And I said, "No, I longed to blow it up, but you'd given me direct orders not to do it." He said, in effect, that, "Well, I'd chosen you because I was told you were the most likely man to disobey orders." So that is a sad mistake on my part. I should have disobeyed orders. This Bush Warfare Battalion, as they came to be known, or the Calvert's Commandos, it was depleting all the time because half the men were still either been sick or wounded. And so we were getting smaller and smaller. But we then went down to Mandalay. We fought some battles there, some engagements, I wouldn't call them battles. And it was when I was there that I met Peter Fleming, whom I'd known before, and he'd been sent in to see me to help in a deception. I've written about this deception in a book called Fighting Mad, not a very good book, which I dictated most of it. It's Wavell's plan. He'd nearly been caught once before by the Japanese when he'd taken off from an airfield. And the plan was that he would pretend that he'd landed at Mandalay And then he was getting away in his limousine, and it would crash, and he would escape, but he would leave his attaché case behind, full of documents. He made up this attaché case, with including letters from his wife, letters to this, and so on and so forth, but also letters to the War Office and this sort of thing, asking for more armour, asking for more aircraft, and saying how many he'd got, and other fairly valuable information which the Japanese, which was to deceive the Japanese, the fact that we had more armour and aircraft and ships in India than we really had. Now, I had a Jeep with Private Williams, and Fleming said that I should drive the limousine, staff car, with the Union Jack on it. But we had to do it realistically. With him was a Captain Coates, who was one of Wavell's ADCs. Some Gurkhas were still fighting south of Mandalay, and then their fighting stopped, and the Japanese started to come along, and it was most awful waiting for this, waiting, you might say, to be overrun by the Japanese. And I eventually was told by Fleming to start the engine. I went to the engine. We'd chosen a place on a curve where I would let the car go over the top of the embankment. I came fast. I wasn't used to cars with such good brakes, and I had to leave skid marks. And so I put on the brakes very heavily, and the car stopped almost dead. It left some skid marks. So I had to start it again, and again some skid marks, and then it toppled slowly over the embankment, and without any damage. So Coates and Peter Fleming, who were all used to this, they got out and broke the windscreen, broke this, left the... they'd got brought a supply of blood of the same texture as Wavell's blood and his ADC's blood, and spilt it all over everything. And then we had to run. Now, they made off for the bridge over the Irrawaddy, and Private Williams and I made off to the Mandalay. When I got there, I found Mandalay had been bombed very heavily, and there were thousands of Indian refugees who were on the waterfront with some bombed river steamers. And amongst them, of course, there are people living. And all medicine we had was some knockout drops or... what's the stuff?
Morphia,
yes. Or morphia. And so we gave this, this ghastly sight, paddling in corpses, and where somebody had struck up an arm and saying, shouting, wailing. We gave them some water and gave them morphia or something like that. But I always remember that as good Hindus, they wouldn't let the cup touch their lips, and you had to pour the water into their mouth. And then I crossed over the Irrawaddy and met up with the remainder of my troops, and we still had to operate, and we were doing the rear guard. And I kept meeting up with Burma headquarters, would send some. There was one very, very good brigadier, I can't remember his name, I've known him in England, who was of enormous help to us. He was administrative brigadier, yet he was organising the whole retreat. Remember, the rest of the troops had retreated 1,000 miles, and there, although they were kept going, they were right down in the dumps. Alexander had no means of influencing the retreat except by his own attitude, and he was very, very good. He would kept his uniform perfect order, and he would go and visit people. He'd chat to them about cricket matches or Army Cup soccer in Aldershot, and say, "I'm sorry." Then he'd say, "I'm sorry, things aren't so good, but I'll try to see we get something get better than I can." And he maintained morale just by his attitude of his unflappability. But he didn't have any reserve, so he couldn't influence the battle. The Japanese were always coming around the wrong way, and I was told to go on to the Chindwin. I took an anti-tank rifle with me, and I had about 4 men. And we sat in a cave. The snag was that my own troops were deteriorating, and we'd almost run out of lorries. I'd used my lorries to evacuate some women and children, and in one case they went off and I never saw the drivers again. Another case, I had to have an armed man whom I could trust next to the driver, otherwise they'd disappear. A retreat and a rout is not a pretty thing. There were masses of refugees trailing along, Indian refugees, and also cholera had struck. A lot of people were dying of cholera at the side. Anyway, it was through dry jungle now, dry, almost desert country. It's known as the dry zone. I went on to the Chindwin and in a cave, waiting for the Japanese to come up. Eventually, a Gurkha company reached me, and with a message that I would come under their command. Well, there was a great curve in the river, and the Gurkha officer was very, very anxious to get back to his battalion. This is one of the snags of infantry, is they always want to get back to their battalion. They don't understand, they should be joyful, the fact that they're out of touch. They can do what they want. That's what Royal Engineers like. They like being out of touch. And so we walked across the cord of this great loop, and when we got to the other side, it was a terrible march, very dry. I went ahead. It was dark by now, and I found the Japanese were landing on a large mud bank. They had lit fires, bonfires, to light themselves up, and they had these landing craft type of boats, which they'd used all the way. And so I quickly went to the... I had 2 men with me. I quickly went to the, I think it was Medalli and Sergeant. I said to the Colonel of the, the Major of the Gurkhas, and who had mortars, 3-inch mortars, and machine guns with him. And I said, there's a marvellous target. The Japanese are on the sandbanks there, and we can mow them down. And I brought him up to show it, and there was a mass of Japanese talking, shouting, pushing things forward, doing this, that, and the other. I don't know what they had. And There were we, about 200 yards from them. I regret to say that I blame this on all infantry, because I came across it later. Instead of going into attack, the Gurkha officer said, well, my orders are to get back and join the battalion. And he pushed off. Unfortunately, he died on the way back, and I was left with these two men and no rations. We tried to make our way back, but we got into the Japanese side of the battle at the last battle in retreat from Burma, which was, I think, was at Kwe Jin. We had been chased by the Japanese a bit, and we were lying in what's known as Endying, E-I-N-D-A-I-N-G, Endying jungle, which is dry jungle with tall trees with large leaves, and the only undergrowths were the sort of shoots from these same trees, which gave a covering of large leaves at about 2 or 3 feet above the ground. Well, we lay in this very hot, steamy area, whilst the British and Indian armies fired off all their artillery before they destroyed their guns and their tanks as well. So we were on the enemy side of the British barrage. Well, we were going to wait till dark, but it was so hot there, and we were longing to have something to drink. So we went down to the riverside and drank and drank and drank. And then we found a boat, but it's got a hole in it, it's been holed. Found another boat that's got a hole in it. So I made up decided to make up a sort of raft. We used our empty water bottles and our packs, and Private Medalli could swim quite well on his back. Sergeant wasn't very good at swimming. So I was towing, I'm quite a good swimmer, I towed the packs, which were just capable of floating, the empty things, along. The Chindrin is about 400 yards wide. There were Japanese on both sides, but we cast off in a rainstorm. And we got quite a long way across when the sergeant said, sorry, sir, I can't go any further. So I said, hang on a moment. I said, you hang on to this packs. And I pushed him along the arm. Medalli was going along, except he was going on his back and he kept swimming the wrong direction. I had to keep him right. And then some Japanese started to fire at us, fortunately from the bank we'd left. Just idle shooting. And then we finally got to the West Bank. And we, unfortunately, Sergeant had let go of the packs. And so all we had was what we stood up in. I had a pair of shorts with 1,000 rupees in it and a revolver. Medalli and Sergeant had nothing very much. They just had a shirt and socks, and one had a pair of shorts. And on this we started our walk back to India. We went up, followed a path. We tried to go through the jungle, which was too difficult on bare feet. So we followed a path, which was very hot, but fortunately no prickles in it. It's a custom in jungle country where people walk barefoot always to remove any thorns from the path. It's a sort of social law, and which I taught people later. And we wandered there. Then we found some food which had been dropped by some Indian refugees, and we ate this, some sugar, which we licked up, even though it's full of ants, and we were pretty emaciated. And we huddled together at night until we eventually came across some Indian refugees, about 100 of them. They received us with open arms. It was marvellous. They were Oriya Indian coolies from the province of Orissa. They were used as railway coolies. They'd got their mothers and fathers and their children. They carried their grandfathers on their backs. They carried mattresses with them. Their distance they moved each day was about 6 miles. They had no cholera with them, fortunately. They gave us some hot, sweet tea with this marvellous sugar. I think it's called jaggery. It's like caked brown sugar. And that's some of the most marvellous tea I've ever drunk. And then they gave us some chapatis and things and allowed us to lie down on the mattresses. You must realize what we were starving, we were emaciated, we were bearded, we had no weapons with us, we had and they'd seen the retreat of the British Army, their lords and masters. They'd been left behind, yet at the same time they behaved just I always thought that quotation from the Bible, we hungered and they gave us eat, we thirsted and they gave us drink, we were naked and they clothed us. But what they did, how they clothed us, they made us put on Indian clothing with saris to cover up our beards and things. And there were Japanese on this side and we walked along with the Indian women. And I remember going through an Indian village and there were Japanese just leaning against the houses with cigarette hanging out of their mouth. And I always remember Medali saying, "What a laugh, what a laugh. Wait till I tell my old dad." And I was telling him to shut up. And our defense was going to be to just scream and run into the jungle if we were to talk tack. But we walked through this village. And eventually we recovered. And so I thought it would be best if we went ahead to try and find the British. And so, still in these Indian clothes, and I had got this 1,000 rupees. And so I gave them 700 rupees, which was a complete... they didn't know that at all. But I do hope it helped them. And we got to where the General Cowan was with his taken over 17th Division. And the intelligence officer rocked with laughter. I'd known him when he saw us. He made me come in to see General Cowan. Cowan said, "I don't want to see any bloody refugees," and this, that, and so on. And then we worked him in, and he stripped the sari off my face, a veil off my face, and said, "My God, Michael, what the hell are you doing?" And I told him what it was, and we gave what orders they were. Instead of getting rest and recuperation,